Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It's an insider's look at the NBA and the culture surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Family Talk with Straight Talk.
You give and you give.
It's time to get with Straight Talk Wireless. You get a reliable 5G network and unlimited data, and you get to choose who joins your family plan starting as low as $25 a line.
Does it have to be family?
It can be family or people you like.
Get more lines and more savings. Switch to Straight Talk for family plans starting as low as $25 a line per month for 4 lines. Find us at Walmart and StraightTalk.com. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Taxes and fees apply.
The Volume.
The thrill and excitement of March Mania is here, and DraftKings Sportsbook, one of America's top-rated sportsbook apps, is giving new customers a shot to turn $5 into $150 instantly in bonus bets with any college basketball bet. UConn is currently the favorite to win the title at plus 500. My favorite team, hometown Tucson, Arizona Wildcats, are currently plus 1300. Plenty of good bets to check out. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code HOOPS. That's H-O-O-P-S. New customers can bet $5 to get $150 instantly in bonus bets. Only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code HOOPS. That's H-O-O-P-S. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8 HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY to 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources. All right, welcome to Hoops Tonight here at The Volume. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope all of you guys are having an incredible week. We have a absolutely jam-packed show today. We're going to start off with the Suns, who continue to impress with a big win on the road over the Cleveland Cavaliers. Kevin Durant, still red hot, big shock. Devin Booker made his return as well. We're going to break that game down from the perspective of both teams. After that, the Golden State Warriors, for the first time this season, won a basketball game without Steph Curry on the road against the Spurs, just after they had lost to the Spurs without Victor Wembanyama at home. A majorly important win considering their situation in the standings, and again, how much they've struggled without Steph this year. After that, we have not taken an opportunity this year to really do a deep dive on Victor Wembanyama's rookie season. And so I took a lot of time this morning digging into all of the numbers, watching a ton of film of all these different play types so that I can give you guys a little scouting report on what Victor Wembanyama's rookie season has been like. And then after that, we have a fun mailbag, about a dozen questions, bunch of different stuff involving NBA history, some stuff with the Lakers. We're going to preview a Nuggets-Bucks potential series should they face in the NBA Finals. A fun mailbag for the end of the show. You guys know the drill before we get started. Subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel. It would mean a lot to me if you guys would take a second to scroll down and hit that subscribe button. Don't forget about our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts, under Hoops Tonight. It's also super helpful if you leave a rating and a review on the podcast feed. Don't forget about my Twitter feed at _JasonLT, where I leave show announcements as well as film threads from time to time. And then last but not least, keep dropping mailbag questions in those YouTube comments. We're going to be doing a few more mailbags over the course of this week. All right, let's talk some basketball. So the Cavs really dominated the Suns early in this game. Phoenix came out in a really deep drop coverage with Yusuf Nurkic, and their guards just weren't really sharp chasing over the top of screens. Again, when we talk about like the pick and roll coverages is like a bracket. That's usually the analogy that I use, in the sense that like your on ball guy is the top half of the bracket and the screen defender is the bottom half of that bracket. And when you do a deep drop coverage, when you pull that side of the bracket further back, this side of the bracket has to be especially sharp. You have to be chasing over the top extremely well and applying a ton of back pressure, because if you do, you can force the guy to keep driving into where your screen defender is. But when you're sloppy at the point of attack and you're in a deep drop coverage, you're going to get killed. And Darius Garland absolutely torched them in the first half of this game, was killing them with pull-up three-point shooting. And then they brought in Drew Eubanks towards the end of the first quarter, and they put Bradley Beal on Darius Garland and started blitzing. And at that point, he was already in rhythm. So he beat Bradley Beal by rejecting his screen once again. Like, when you bring the screen defender way up to the level, he has to pick a side of the screen. And so it becomes that much more important for the on-ball defender to not get beat the other way, because if you get beat the other way, you have no backside help. Beal got beat the other way once. There was a possession where they hard blitzed and Darius Garland just hit like a crazy drifting three along the right corner, because at that point he's just already in rhythm. Again, like, a lot of times we overlook what happens at the beginning of the game. Like, it doesn't set the tone. If you allow a ball handler to get comfortable and confident, then even when you ratchet up the defensive intensity, that guy's already feeling good. That guy's already in rhythm. It's really hard to slow them down at that point. There was another play late first half where they lost Garland on a baseline out of bounds, where Eubanks, even though he was supposed to be up at the level blitzing, he was way far back in the lane on the baseline out of bounds. They just did a quick little a dribble handoff with Damian Jones in the left corner. Darius Garland got another three. So just nowhere near good enough defensively to start this game. They found themselves down by 19 points. But then right around that middle of the second quarter, the Suns started to get going offensively. They really started to attack Georges Niang. And this is one of those things where having Devin Booker back has a bunch of positive effects down the roster. And it's not just having the ability to have another player, the quality of Devin Booker to initiate offense, it affects the matchups down the court. It affects your off-ball spacing for actions that KD and Devin and Bradley Beal run, right? Like, we're going to be talking a lot about that over the course of this show, but specifically as it pertains to them attacking Georges Niang, when you have Devin Booker out there, and Devin Booker and Bradley Beal are both going to draw a significantly tough perimeter defense type of assignment, right? In that situation, you just run out of bodies. And so the Cavs ended up opting to put Georges Niang on Kevin Durant straight up. And so KD was doing a lot of work on him in ISO. Any screening action where he would get switched, Kevin Durant would just point at Devin Booker or point at Bradley Beal and be like, go take him. And they were just literally taking turns just cooking Georges Niang on an island. To Georges Niang's credit, like, he was competing. He was really trying. He's overmatched in those specific situations. They were also having a lot of success with Spain pick and roll. This is an action that the Suns used to run a ton back in the Monty Williams era with Chris Paul. And it's different players, obviously, aside from Devin Booker, different coach now, but it's more or less the same concept. Again, it's just a ball screen, but you have a shooter come up to back screen the screen defender, as he's relocating to the top of the key, which opens up two different things. It opens up the lob pass, but it also makes it really difficult for the screen defender to get back and help protect the rim. And so they were having success with that as well. And then as they started to get going offensively, attacking Niang and scoring in ball screens, that triggered their defensive intensity. And then from there, they were able to regain control of the game after being down 19. They did a much better job on Darius Garland in the second half. They brought Yusuf Nurkic up into a high drop instead of a deep drop. That's where you're up at the level contesting and then just rotating back as best as you can. And Nurkic was Nurkic, every time I watch him, he had a not his best game in this particular matchup, and they ended up closing with Eubanks instead, just because of his foot speed and because Nurkic wasn't quite as sharp. But Nurkic made some defensive plays in this game in his drop coverage, especially at the start of the second half. And like, honestly, every time I watch Nurkic, I'm always impressed by just how much he tries to make plays defensively despite his lack of foot speed. But bringing him up to the level and then just much better on-ball defense helped them really cool off Darius Garland in the second half of this game. In general, their intensity went up to the level where We even saw Devin Booker flying around and getting a bunch of offensive rebounds in that third quarter. He had a possession where he had three offensive rebounds on the same possession, just shooting in from the wing and beating people to the ball. Ended up hitting like a little bank shot on the fourth offensive possession of their fourth shot of that possession. He had four offensive rebounds in total, had a nice tap out rebound later on in the third quarter. So the Suns just kind of methodically worked their way back in. They go up by nine, but then Cleveland, who's again capable of real defensive runs as well, they locked in on defense, and the game just turned into an absolute slog on both ends of the floor. Cleveland briefly tied the score at 104, but then Phoenix got an easy layup for Devin Booker out of another Spain pick and roll. And they just had Grayson Allen come up and back screen Jarrett Allen as they were running the ball screen, and Devin Booker was able to kind of gather through the digging down defender out of the left corner and finish with a left-handed layup. Then a couple possessions later, they had a really good defensive possession where they blitzed Darius Garland at the top of the key and got into rotation as Garland hit Jared Allen slipping, and Jared Allen made a kick out to the left corner, and it was like bang, 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 balls getting passed around. But every Sun was just on a string flying around. They ended up forcing a tough skip pass that Royce O'Neal was splitting the difference between two offensive players and was able to get a steal. They ran out the other way, and Kevin Durant got a layup. Suns built a little bit of a margin again, and they were able to kind of stiff arm them from there. Got a little sketchy late. Phoenix got a little sloppy in the late fourth quarter here. Couple of bad turnovers. Gave up four offensive rebounds in the corner. They were just a quarter. They just weren't boxing out. But Grayson Allen got two key stops at the end of the game in ISO against Darius Garland. The first time he slid his feet really well and stopped him in the middle of the floor, killed the possession. And then after that, there was the play where Jared Allen actually had a decent opportunity to tie the game with a lob pass. But I want to give Grayson Allen some credit here. So I think it was 113-111, so it's a two-point game. Darius Garland had just tried attacking Grayson Allen and couldn't beat him. So then on this possession, he's on the left wing, Grayson Allen on an island. He's picking on him in a switch. They're specifically going after Grayson Allen here. Grayson Allen slides his feet and cuts off like four or five different moves from Darius Garland. And then finally, after like the fifth or sixth move, Garland's able to get an angle on Grayson and beat him off the dribble. But at that point, when he beat him off the dribble, he was so sped up by just the sheer number of moves he had just made that when he threw the lob pass, he threw it too high. And it's one of those things, like, you have your jobs in when you switch, when you're the weaker defender that someone's targeting. No one's expecting you to suddenly turn into Jaden McDaniels and get a bunch of stops. Like, what they're expecting you is just to do the best you can. And in that situation, against a quick guard like Darius Garland, especially one that had been shooting the three really well, and you got to factor in time and score, like in a two-point game, the last thing you want to do is give up a step-back three to a guy who's been hitting his three all night long. And suddenly you're down by one and it's a completely different game. Trust your backside help, chase him off the line. And he just made him make enough moves, made him work hard enough that he sped the play up, and just a little bit of a difference. Like, that pass is 6 inches lower and 6 inches to the right. Jared Allen dunks the ball and it's a tie game. But no, it was a little bit too high and a little bit to the left. Jared Allen, the ball was like on the backboard when Jared Allen caught it, and that kind of disrupted his catch, and he fumbled it away, and they were able to get a stop, and they escaped with a huge road win in Cleveland. And again, like, especially after you cut, like, you know, this is typical, right? Especially on the road, especially against a team that I don't think Phoenix sees as particularly threatening, especially without Donovan Mitchell in the lineup. Like, it's just kind of trap game, especially after a couple of really tough games against the Nuggets and Celtics, right? And you get slapped in the face early and you find yourself down big, but they methodically executed their way back into the game. And then they were able to close the game out in the fourth quarter, which obviously has been an issue for them at times this season. Major takeaways on the Suns front. Good comeback game for Devin Booker, 27 points and 7 assists on 50% shooting. Really active as an athlete in the second half, not just on the glass, but defensively as well. Interesting adjustment from Frank Vogel to go with Drew Eubanks late in the game, so they had more speed on the floor to deal with Garland. Especially, they did some switching and more blitzing at the end of the game with Garland, and they just needed more speed in that situation. Kevin Durant still on an absolute heater. That's his fourth straight game with at least 35 points, barbecuing Georges Niang like we were talking about. But again, one of the key things for Phoenix that I've been paying attention to, real defensive runs. We've seen that in the Denver matchup. We saw that even for stretches in the Celtics game, again, to get back into the game in that third quarter run, and then held the Cavs to 20 points in the fourth quarter as well. Just really impressive defensive ceiling that they're starting to demonstrate, even if it's not as consistent as you would like it to be. I saw a video from KOC, Kevin O'Connor from The Ringer this morning. He was on his podcast with Chris Vernon talking about whether or not the Suns were the biggest threat to the Nuggets out west. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm still a little bit on the fence because I think the Clippers just have better defensive personnel, but the Clippers have been pretty mediocre for like a month now. And the Suns are really starting to put together some high level basketball. They're starting to attach some high level defense to the work that they're doing offensively with the three stars. And it's really starting to take shape. I'm kind of like, let's just put it this way. I still think I lean slightly towards the Clippers, but I'd put the Suns like pretty much on that level at this point, really starting to believe in them. I think they have some good matchup advantages across the board. Again, specifically like when KD is making his pull-up jump shot, he doesn't really get bothered that much by Aaron Gordon. It's just a question of whether or not he can make them. And then Yusuf Nurkic, just a big body that can actually bang with Jokic and cause him some issues down there. They are absolutely a threat. I'm just not quite sure if I'd put them on the same level as the Clippers at this point. On Cleveland, this is a classic issue I see around the league with a lot of these smaller guards, especially ones that aren't like absolutely insane athletes. The difference between playing against a deep drop coverage versus more aggressive coverages and in ISO situations. So like Darius Garland in the first half was just absolutely cooking the Suns because they weren't very aggressive on the ball. There wasn't a ton of ball pressure and they were in just such a deep drop coverage. And so he was able to get going with what I call like baked in shots. Like these are shots that are the coverage itself is designed to give up. So like in that, the point being like, if anybody at the, like, just take a random, you know, college basketball player is capable of hitting a mid-range 16 footer, right? Like then if this coverage literally concedes that shot. So like anybody can make that shot. Now the best players in the world can make it at a much higher rate, right? And Garland is absolutely barbecuing it, but there's a difference between the shot that is baked into the coverage versus what happens when the intensity picks up and suddenly there are no baked in shots and it's shots that you have to create yourself. And like, don't get me wrong, Garland still had some success getting downhill when they started bringing aggressive coverages and hitting the slipper, and that's still creating an advantage in those situations. But when it comes to scoring the basketball, Darius Garland is definitely one of those guys that kind of needs some of the shots that are baked into the coverage. He's not a guy that, like, against really elite locked-in physical defense can consistently just generate his own shot on an island. And I thought that those last two possessions against Grayson Allen and just how difficult it was for Darius Garland to break free, I thought was a strong indicator of that. Because Grayson Allen at the guard position is very much an average defensive player, right? Just something to keep in mind. And honestly, that's why you need a guy like Donovan Mitchell. And I've actually come around in a lot of ways on the Mitchell Garland backcourt in the sense that, like, when Donovan Mitchell is defending the way that he's defended this season and really leveraging his athletic gifts, that's where it starts to look more like that skill guard, athlete guard type of mold. It's when Donovan Mitchell leans into the skill guard stuff and doesn't compete as an athlete that backcourt becomes untenable. So like, I actually believe more in the Garland Mitchell backcourt now than I used to, just because of Donovan Mitchell's leap that he's taken just in the dirty work areas of the game this year. But I did think that game last night was just an indicator of the ceiling, the certain ceiling that Darius Garland has as a scorer, which depends so much on what the defensive coverages are. Obviously, no Evan Mobley just means a lot of Georges Niang. And Georges Niang was just having one of those games where he wasn't hitting shots. And if he's not hitting shots and he's such an easy target on the defensive end of the floor, things can fall apart pretty quickly. But even despite all of that, like Jared Allen, better pass from Darius Garland on that last possession. And Jared Allen catches the ball cleanly. It's a 113-113 game. And the real reason why they had that chance is because they are still capable of these crazy defensive runs like they went on in the like late third quarter into the fourth quarter. And that, again, is like, defense just will just keep you in basketball games. And again, like that's, I think when you factor in the improvement that Donovan Mitchell has made and just the improvement in terms of the overall amount of offensive skill on the floor, if they can compete defensively well enough to keep these games close, as long as Donovan Mitchell's hitting shots, they have a chance to beat anybody. It's just a question of whether or not he can kind of meet other stars at that level as a shot maker.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider's look at the NBA and the culture surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall will give his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. CJ will bring his A-list comedian buddies to keep it light and fire off some hoops takes. Plus, John will be inviting current and former NBA players, friends, and teammates to join the show as well to give their unfiltered accounts of what really goes on in the league from a player's perspective. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Does the craziness of everyday life leave you feeling stressed and shedding? Since having kids, have you started to see a little more of your scalp? Are you unhappy with your hairline? When it comes to thinning hair, there are many root causes at play, and Nutrafol addresses them through a multi-targeted, whole-body approach. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, and faster-growing hair with less shedding. Physician-formulated, with drug-free ingredients, Nutrafol supports healthy hair growth from within by targeting key root causes of thinning: stress, hormones, environment, nutrition, lifestyle, and metabolism, through whole-body health. Take their hair wellness quiz at Nutrafol.com for a personalized hair health plan based on your specific root causes. With Nutrafol, building a hair growth routine is simple. Purchase online, no prescription or doctor's visits required. Free shipping and automated deliveries ensure you'll never miss a day, and you'll see results in 3 to 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker and healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code Hoops. That's H-O-O-P-S. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and stylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com, spelled N-U-T-R-A-F-O-L.com, promo code Hoops, H-O-O-P-S. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code Hoops. All right, moving on to our next segment, we're going to be breaking down the Golden State Warriors on the road, getting their first win of the season without Steph Curry in the lineup. Another defensive run. The Spurs had 68 points with 10 minutes to go in the third quarter. They led by 10, 68 to 58. And the Spurs had 72 points with a little over 3 minutes left in the third quarter. So they held them to just 4 points over a seven-minute span. At that point, the Warriors were up 14, 86 to 72. So a 28-4 run in about 7 minutes of basketball. They logged a defensive rating of 78.3 in that quarter. On tape, just really good game plan discipline. Lots of lineups because it spans the middle of the third quarter. Multiple lineups for both teams were on the floor during that stretch. But the gist of it was, any screening action that involved Draymond Green, Andrew Wiggins, and Jonathan Kuminga was a switch. They were willing to switch Wiggins and Kuminga onto Victor Wembanyama in those screening actions, which shut those particular actions down. Obviously, they had some issues like Victor Wembanyama had a drop step dunk on Jonathan Kuminga and a switch where he just didn't really hold his ground well enough. But then when the guards were on the ball, so whether it was Podziemski or Gary Payton, they were just ducking under picks on Trey Jones. So they would live with pull-up threes on Trey Jones. And then they were chasing like crazy on Devin Vassell. And both guys were awesome in the stretch. Both Brandon Podziemski and Gary Payton just really controlled that perimeter defense stretch after the middle portion of the fourth quarter when the guards checked in. I clipped a specific possession of Gary Payton II, just showing him chasing around on Devin Vassell. And, you know, one of the things that Gary Payton does super well that's always impressed me is he's so incredibly athletic that he's capable of gambling or taking risks, jumping into passing lanes or reaching and getting off of balance, but still has the speed to recover. And in this specific play that I clipped that you'll find on my Twitter feed at @_JasonLT, there's an example of Gary Payton lunging on one side of the screen and then chasing over the top and reaching in aggressively. And yet in both situations, having the speed to recover. So when Devin Vassell got downhill and got to like a little pull up 15 footer along the left baseline, he actually got a great contest on it just because he has the crazy speed to be able to recover after being aggressive. And that, I think that sort of thing is super frustrating for offensive players because like you have these counter moves designed, like when a guy makes an aggressive move, I whip it behind my back this way and I have an angle, but it's like against the best athletes in the world, they can just recover. And it's like, shit, I did everything right on that possession and he's still right in my face. Right. And then Trayce Jackson-Davis was just really a force around the rim defensively in the second half of this game. Actually had a possession in the fourth quarter where he blocked Trey Jones and Zach Collins back-to-back on the same possession. Weirdly enough, didn't get credited for a block in the box score, which I thought was really interesting. And then on the offensive end of the floor, Klay Thompson and Chris Paul did a really nice job running the offense. Klay was able to hit some jumpers against the Spurs in their drop coverage and, you know, some of those classic, like, come off of a dribble handoff, the guy's kind of in a trail position and just hits him with the hard, like, right shoulder step back moving to his left and knock it down, like that sort of thing. Chris has his usual Chris and Trayce Jackson-Davis pick and roll chemistry thing just on level 10 throughout this entire game. Hit him for lobs and finishes around there. Trayce had a ridiculous right-handed finish around Zach Collins where he jumped into him and then, like, scooped around with his offhand to finish. But just a ridiculous play. We haven't even got to it yet, but, like, at the end of the game when Victor Wembanyama reached to his right-hand side and he spun off of him, just one of the most ridiculous dunks you'll ever see as he like palmed it as best as he could and just threw it over the top of the rim into Victor Wembanyama. That's a highlight that Trayce will be looking at for the rest of his life, I'm sure, especially when Victor's running roughshod over the rest of the league in 5 years. I'm sure that'll be a fun one for him to look back at. But Chris had his mid-range jump shot going as well. He had 6 shots in the mid-range in this game, which obviously is such an important part of Chris being able to navigate in pick and roll situations. He has to be a threat to score in order to bring the screen defender up enough to open up those roll man opportunities. And that's what just kind of brings that two man game to fruition, is like Chris's willingness and ability to knock down those mid range jump shots. And then Trayce after the screen rolling hard to the rim and bringing that vertical spacing. Andrew Wiggins had 16 points on 8 shots. He had a massive 3 in the third quarter, kind of moving to his right. He's really bringing confidence to the three-point stroke now that we haven't seen really since the playoffs in 2022, shooting 49% from 3 on 3.3 attempts per game in his last 18 games, averaging 14 points and shooting 54% from the field overall. So Andrew Wiggins, really encouraging stretch from him as of late. And then Jonathan Kuminga, 22 points, the usual, getting out in transition, hit a couple ISO jumpers, attacking in face-up situations. Big win for the Warriors. This was a tough one because, again, the Spurs have been sneaky tough to play for a while now. As the Warriors know very well, they just lost to him at home without Victor Wembanyama. And so adding Wemby on the road, really nice bounce back win, a very important one for them in the standings as well. So obviously we have not taken the time yet this season. We've had brief conversations about Wemby, but we haven't really talked about his season in totality. And I haven't, because of how bad the Spurs have been, I haven't really taken the time to dig into Victor Wembanyama and the tape and the numbers this year. So that's what I wanted to do here for a few minutes, is just kind of do like a deep dive on Victor Wembanyama's rookie season. So for the season, averaging 21 points, 10 rebounds, and 3 assists, 1.3 steals, 3.4 blocks on 57% true shooting. Obviously awesome. But since December 28th, Victor took a leap in the middle of the season, which is something we'll talk about in a little bit. But since December 28th, so his last 31 games, 23 points per game, 10 rebounds, and 4 assists, 1.2 steals with 3.7 blocks per game, 50% from the field, 38% from 3, and 82% from the line. So 60.4% true shooting. So before we go any further, a rookie averaging 23, 10, and 4 with 5 stocks per game on over 60% true shooting is completely insane, especially when you factor in that, like, most rookies around this time of year start to hit a wall. They start to struggle with fatigue because the length of the season is just different than what they've dealt with when they were younger. Although overseas, Victor obviously has had a different experience than most college players. So Victor's probably more capable of handling the physical nature of an 82-game season. But still, it's an adjustment. It's different than what he was dealing with. But for all rookies, that's an adjustment, right? We're seeing Brandon Podziemski run into this a little bit with the Warriors, right? Also, teams have started to put together a good amount of film. So, like, again, when you look at scouting, once you have like 50 games worth of sample, these scouting departments, they have really good data to look at. And they can really find out, like, okay, this particular action, if we guard it like this, he struggles. In ISO, if we sit on this hand and we prepare for this counter move, we can handle it, right? Like, there are a lot of ways that teams just get better at scouting rookies as more film becomes available. And so many rookies run into a wall at this point in the year, and instead Victor Wembanyama is just going up a level. And again, 23, 10, and 4 with 5 stocks and over 60% true shooting is just completely insane for a rookie, regardless of the circumstances. So looking into play type data, he's having a tough spot-up season, 0.77 points per possession, which is really bad. There are 143 players in the NBA that have logged at least 150 spot-up possessions, and that ranks 140th. So he's been one of the worst spot-up players in the league. Combination of a couple things. He's really struggling in catch-and-shoot situations. He's been a good jump shooter, a decent jump shooter in pull-up situations, but he's been really bad off the catch. That's a concept we're going to dive into a little bit more when we get to the off-the-dribble shooting. But also, just when he attacks closeouts, he has a tendency to drive into traffic. And tall guys have issues dribbling the basketball in general when it comes into traffic. By the way, this is something that happens with Kevin Durant, which is why he turns the ball over more than most of his peers that are perimeter ball handlers. It's because when you're just dribbling it that high off the ground, there's just a larger distance for defenders to get involved with disrupting the basketball, right? And so you have to be really careful as a tall player about when and where you drive the basketball. And so just struggling to shoot, catch and shoot, and struggling to maintain control of the basketball when he drives into traffic, those are the main things that are hurting him in spot-up situations. He's been very good in ball screens as the screener. He's shooting 59% in effective field goal percentage when he pops or rolls, which is awesome. He's in the 60th percentile overall in points per possession on roll man possessions, which, especially when you factor in the spacing that he's around, really impressive. There's a lot of guys on the Spurs that teams just don't need a guard at the three-point line, or they're conceding threes to Keldon Johnson. They're ducking under picks on Trey Jones. No one's guarding Jeremy Sochan out there. Like, there's just a lot of ability to kind of pack the paint on him, which can cause some issues for any basketball player, let alone a rookie. On the ball, he's run 183 inverted ball screens, resulting in 0.86 points per possession, including passes. Passes out of those ball screens, almost about two-thirds of the time. A lot of turnovers in those situations. He turns it over about 30% of the time that he passes out of ball screens. Really, he just makes really aggressive passes to the slipper. So, like, when he sets those inverted ball screens, he's getting pretty aggressive coverages, and those guards are slipping out of it. And, like, they get a lot of, for the record, they get a lot of great stuff out of this, too, where, like, he'll throw the pocket pass and the guard will have, like, a good angle and get into the paint and finish. They had a similar play in the second half against the Warriors last night. I want to say it was Malachi Branham that slipped, but I can't remember exactly. But they hit a little pocket pass, get a layup in the middle of the lane. But he kind of throws it every time, regardless of whether or not it's open. So that's just a rookie thing. Like, in time, he'll just get better about being more picky about when he makes that pass, because sometimes it's not open, right? Or sometimes it's better to throw the swing pass and let the swing pass guy make the pass if he has a better angle, right? And then he's personally shooting just 41% out of ball screens as the handler. Similar kind of stuff that we were talking about earlier. He's actually been pretty good at shooting pull-up threes in that situation, but when he puts on the ball on the floor and tries to drive, again, when he gets into traffic, he can have some issues. ISO, he's been awesome. 94 points on 88 ISOs, including passes. Really deadly face-up jumper. It's something that he's been shooting really well all season. It's funny, certain shot types he's been shooting really well. He's been really good in face-up jumpers, pretty average in dribble jumpers, and then bad in catch and shoot jumpers. Now, face-up jumpers are like, I catch, I turn, and I face. Maybe I rise up if I have space, or maybe I jab step, and then I rise up. That's what I qualify as a face-up jumper. On Synergy, they classify them as early jumpers, but it more or less means the same thing. But he's got, in the ISO situations, a lot of face-up jumpers, good step back going both directions. When he drives, he likes to, when he gets cut off, moving towards his right, he likes to step back going right or spin back towards his left-hand side. And sometimes when he gets into that spin, he can get into some trouble where he'll turn the basketball over. But overall, he's been really good in ISOs. Okay in the post, 256 possessions, 241 points at 0.94 points per possession. That ranks ninth out of the 10 guys in the league that are high-volume post-up players over 250 possessions. Once again, surrounding talent and shooting are the important, like, kind of context there. He's not in a situation where guys are going to make teams pay consistently for throwing second defenders at him. At his best in the post, it's when he's quick and decisive, like catching second defender, quick kickout pass, just like really fast decision making, and then also quick aggressive moves towards the rim. Doesn't really need to shoot a hook shot, thankfully, just because of how tall he is. And he'll just make like an aggressive move towards the middle and like almost shoot like a sliding scoop shot with his left hand into the lane, or a sliding scoop shot with his right hand in the lane. Like, he'll just catch and basically pivot over that shoulder right away. Even if the defender bumps him and kind of flattens out the drive, as long as he's close enough to the basket. And the Spurs do a lot of smart stuff. They run him off of a ton of wedge screens where they'll start him at the elbow and like screen, have him flash to the post to try to get him some deeper position. And like, again, just quickly pivoting towards the middle over whatever shoulder that is and going to that scoop shot in the lane. He'll get a bunch of good stuff out of that. Again, when he goes quick, that's when he's best. Has a tendency sometimes to settle for unnecessary tough, like turnaround jump shots off the glass and stuff like that. That's usually where he'll have misses in those situations. Had a really good post-up sequence against Indiana late in a win last week. It was 103 to 102 with 4 minutes left. The Spurs were up. He had an aggressive baseline move on Siakam, just one of those quick attacks to get a and one. And then he had an aggressive move on Turner on the opposite block where he drew a foul. And then on the next possession, they hard double teamed him and he hit Jeremy Sochan on a cut and he made a layup at the basket. So like spamming an action to close a game against a really good team. And again, Indiana's defense has not been very good since Siakam came over, but that is, in terms of personnel, a good defensive front line. And Miles Turner and Pascal Siakam and Wemby was just going right through him like tissue paper. In terms of shot types, he's been a bad jump shooter overall, 0.88 points per shot overall. That's a 26th percentile mark for jump shooting. Catch and shoot, 0.82 points per shot overall, 30% field goals, 41% when you weight it for threes. When he's guarded, 28%, 38% weighted for threes. And when he's unguarded, 32%, 46% weighted for threes. So just all really bad and all areas where he'll need to improve in the long run. But his pull-up jump shot has been really, really deadly this year. He's got 35.4% field goal percentage on pull-up jump shots, 49% weighted for threes. So right around a point per possession. To give you an idea, he's been about as effective hitting pull-up jump shots as Jason Tatum, which again, as a rookie, is a really, really impressive mark. But again, it's the face-up jumpers where he's been best, shooting 41% overall on face-up jump shots, 54% weighted for threes. So question is, why is it that Victor Wembanyama has struggled so much in catch and shoot situations, but has been pretty good in pull up and face up situations? To me, it's all about rhythm. And Wemby has a tendency to get a little bit loose with his jump shot form in the sense that like he's relying a lot on just the release at the end. His base gets a little funky on these where like he's drifting a lot on his like off the dribble shots. He'll drift to the left or drift to the right. There was a flashing, like kind of like a movement shooter type of shot he took against the Warriors in the second half last night where Draymond was guarding him and he was under the basket and he flashed up to the left wing and he caught and like quick turn and pivot and shot. Literally looked like a movement shooter. But on it, like he randomly jumped like forward into the left quite a bit. Even though he was unguarded, he jumped like forward to the Draymond got a late contest on it, but he jumped like forward into the left a little bit. And it's just like different than what he does on a bunch of other possessions. And so by the way, this is super typical for young basketball players. And like one of the things that he'll just have to figure out in the long run is getting super consistent with his form. And like, to me, you actually want to build it out of catch and shoot. So like you want to have like this perfect muscle memory from the base up in your catch and shoot shots. And once you nail that down, you want your off the dribble shots to more or less resemble that in the sense that like, obviously there's going to be some drifting, but when you get enough separation to go straight up and down, go straight up and down. When you're drifting, get great lift and at least from the waist up, have the exact same type of release and motion as you do when you're shooting catch and shoot jump shots. Once you can connect those two, then you'll see the numbers more consistent across the board. But right now it's like when he's in a rhythm because he's touching the basketball, he shoots well, but when he has to catch and shoot, not so well. When he can actually build out his catch and shoot as the foundation of his jump shot and then connect that to his off the dribble shooting, that's when I think we'll see some real shooting consistency from him. But the touch is there. I have no doubt that in the long run, he's going to be a great shooter. 35% on floaters, only 10 makes on the season though, so it's not a shot he takes a lot. Only 43% on hooks, 16 makes though on the entire season. Like we talked about earlier, doesn't really need it because he's so damn tall. So it's more like he'll, like most players, well, on the block, like drop step and then shoot like a little half hook over their left shoulder. Wemby can go out to the side and almost like take a scoop shot. So like it's not really relevant to him just because it's not a shot he needs to take. At the rim, 131 dunks. That's tied for the sixth most in the NBA. Here's a little trivia. You guys want to guess who the six players are that are either tied or above him? Number six, Nick Claxton. Number five, Jarrett Allen. Number four, Aaron Gordon. Number three, Anthony Davis. Number two, Rudy Gobert. Number one, drumroll, Giannis Antetokounmpo. Big shock, I know. But still, Victor Wembanyama in limited minutes at sixth in the most dunks in the NBA. Only 54% on layups, obviously a big area of improvement for him. gets knocked off of his base relatively easily, and has some, can occasionally have some bad misses around the rim. But that again is just something, I think it comes down to both driving into traffic and just being better about his drive pass decisions, and then two, just putting on a little bit more bulk. On the defensive end, he's already one of the best defensive players in the world. He currently has the second best odds on DraftKings in the league to win Defensive Player of the Year. Leads the league in blocks in limited minutes. As a matter of fact, if you extrapolate it out to a 36-minute shift, he's averaging 4.3 blocks per 36 minutes. Fourth in deflection rate among players who've played at least 1,500 minutes this season. So just wreaking havoc on the defensive end of the floor. He has this tendency, this ability that most players don't have, to hang back and make it look like there's an opening, but then just take a simple drop step and reach and be able to cover like 15 feet of space. And it just makes it so that he can really bait players into situations that they don't want to get into. And most of the, I shouldn't say most, but a good percentage of the blocks that Victor Wembanyama have, they're not like plays where guys are challenging him. They're plays where they don't even think he's around. And then suddenly he's just there. And that's just the advantage of his ability to kind of disguise whether or not he's coming in help or not. So in summary, he's already impacting winning at a high level. The Spurs are 6.2 points better per 100 possessions when he's on the court versus when he's off. He's already a top 25 player in the league, in my opinion, and he can still get so much better on both ends of the floor. Some specifics, again, improving as a shooter in every phase of the game, which we talked about already, so I won't get into again. Limiting turnovers, specifically being more careful about when he tries to thread the needle in pick and roll passing situations, just being more deliberate. Again, if it's not open, you can literally just swing the pass, get it back, and run another one. Like, you don't need to force it in that specific action. Dribbling into traffic as well. Just when he's attacking closeouts or driving in ball screens or ISO situations, just being more picky about when he exposes the basketball. And then lastly, like all young players, just kind of shot selection stuff. So like finding the right place for tough shot making and then maximizing the capitalizing on the low-hanging fruit, right? Like, this is what we talk about with Jokic all the time. Like, the dude is the best in the league at grabbing all of the low-hanging fruit on offense. And Victor has that type of potential to be a guy who gets 20, 25 points a game just on the easy stuff that's sitting there right in front of him. And so then the tough shot-making stuff can push him over the top. Now, right now, despite all of these classic rookie issues, he's averaging 26 points and 13 rebounds per 36 minutes right now for the season. And he's still adjusting to the league. So, like, there's no reason at all why we couldn't see a five-year run in Victor Wembanyama's prime, where he averages, like, 32, 15, and 7 with, like, 6 stocks per game. Like, that's on the table for him. That's not even a long shot. That almost feels like a certainty. Like, right now, he's getting you 26 and 13 per 36 as a rookie. That's for the season, not including this latest leap that he's been on. There's no reason at all to think that it's some improved shooting, bumping his minutes up, just overall better decision-making and veteran experience, that he can't be up around 32 points per game. He's already grabbing 13 rebounds per game. That's not a big leap to get up to 15. And he's averaging 4 assists per game over this last 31-game stretch. And he's still learning how to read the NBA floor. And so, and he's playing around guys that struggle to finish plays around him. So it's just, there's no reason at all to think that he can't get up to that type of level. 32, 15, and 7, I think, is like an interesting kind of goal for Victor to hit during his prime. And then again, the last thing I'll say about Victor, took a big leap in the middle of the season when most rookies go down a level. That to me is just a huge indicator of his work ethic and his competitiveness. And that to me, just that's like the swing factor in what, if you look at like Victor's career as a spectrum of results, meaning like the best possible version of his career and the worst possible version of his career based on his talent, it's his competitiveness and work ethic along with some injury luck that will determine where he lands on that scale. Injury luck's outside of your control, but Victor, for the record, works extremely hard on pliability and flexibility and all that kind of stuff. And so he's doing everything he can on his end to avoid injuries. Obviously, the Spurs have been really careful with his minutes and stuff as well. So that, you do what you can to control that, but his competitiveness and his work ethic, I think, are going to help him hit the high end of that spectrum. Sky's the limit for Victor. And it was really fun diving into his film this morning.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider's look at the NBA and the culture surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall will give his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. CJ will bring his A-list comedian buddies to keep it light and fire off some hoops takes. Plus, John will be inviting current and former NBA players, friends, and teammates to join the show as well to give their unfiltered accounts of what really goes on in the league from a player's perspective. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yeah, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card. All right, let's get to the mailbag. Since the 2021 season, AD bulked up a bit to better fit the center position. What are the pros and cons of this bigger build and playing center overall? So I think it's the pros are, in theory, it should help him bang with other big centers underneath the basket. And he, for the record, he does do better than he used to in that regard. And he, there are guys that he can bully now that he didn't used to be able to bully. There's been some upside there. Also, I think it's probably helped him a little bit with his injury prevention, just by virtue of him just being a little bit more sturdy in his joints and stuff like that. That said, like, I think the cons have outweighed the pros on that front. Like, his foot speed is substantially lower than it was before he bulked up. And then also, I really think it's led to some stiffness in his joints, in the sense that he hasn't been as fluid as a scorer. And, you know, for whatever that's worth, like, I tend to think, like, lean into your advantage. Like, don't play big guy basketball when you're not as good at playing big guy basketball as Nikola Jokic, right? Like, don't, you're not good. Like, you're still running into the Zubaches and the Saboniss and the Nurkic's and the Jokic's of the world and struggling. And that's the only matchup where that size really makes that much of a difference. So if it were up to me, I would have leaned more into AD's speed and been like, yeah, there are going to be some matchups where we struggle because, you know, AD's getting buried. But, like, as long as we're playing hard around him and we have advantage of his ability to cover ground in rotation, there's going to be so much more good than bad that comes from that. Also, I just think the Lakers would have been in a much better position offensively if they had the Anthony Davis from the bubble that was capable of being really a high-level perimeter scorer. And he's just gone down a massive level in that department, which I do think is connected to some of his strength. So, again, there are pros that have come with it, and I understand why, like, conceptually why he did it. But personally, if I was Anthony Davis, I would have lingered more around the body type he was in 2020. Hey, Jason, I love this channel, and I think you provide desperately needed, insightful content, especially for a casual viewer, and keep up the great work. Thank you for the kind words and for supporting the show. I'm not a guy who generally likes plug-and-play players into certain eras and teams, but I cannot help but wonder, what if someone like DeMar DeRozan or Paul George was on AI's finals team? I think the type of player that would greatly benefit the chances of that series being at least more competitive. But then again, who is guarding Shaq still? Yeah, Shaq still would have been a massive problem. But that was a team that grinded it out and just depended on Allen Iverson to take and make tough shots. And so specifically, the guy that I think would have been an interesting option there is a DeMar DeRozan, just because he was the kind of guy that, like, you could really in my opinion, a better, like, on an island scorer than Paul George can be, because Paul George is just a little bit too dependent on his three-point shot. He's not as good at drawing fouls. DeMar DeRozan, I think, like, is a little bit bigger and sturdier for some of the more physical play back then. I think Paul George, for the record, is a better player than DeMar DeRozan right now. That's not what I'm trying to say. But I just think in that, like, kind of boxed in, like, we just need someone to grind out points type of environment alongside that Sixers team in 2001, I think DeMar DeRozan would have been a really interesting fit. Next question. Hey, Jason, first off, I love the show. Big LeBron fan here, and I know you are as well. I've said for years that I think personally the 2017 Cavs were better than the 2016 title team, and that they just ran into the best team ever. I know their regular season wasn't great, but when you look at the playoffs, their run was insane. Curious if you agree and if you can provide some context as well. So I thought the 17 Cavs were obviously a much better offensive team than the 2016 team. LeBron James kind of went up a level as a scorer between that from 2016 into that 2017-2018 stretch. LeBron really went up a level in terms of his consistency and his jump shot. and just his overall feel as a scorer. It was LeBron was really peaking in his offensive skill in that 2017-2018 range. Also, like, they just had totally nailed down all their spacing concepts and the 1-2 punch of Kyrie and LeBron. They were really humming on all cylinders offensively, but it was one of their worst seasons of that era in terms of their overall focus and energy on the defensive end of the floor. And so here's the thing. I don't think it would have mattered under any circumstances with how good that 2017 Warriors team was. However, had Kevin Durant not gone to the Warriors, and 2017 was more or less a rematch of the Harrison Barnes Warriors versus the 2017 Cavs, I think it would have been a great series, but the Cavs would have been in some trouble in the sense that, like, even in that playoff run, they didn't really need to defend that much. And so I wonder if their defense in 2016, they were just much sharper defensively overall from start to finish in the season. And so I don't know what would have happened if the Cavs and Warriors rematched in 2017. I really wanted to see that, which is what kind of sucked about Kevin Durant going there, is it just kind of ruined what would have been a really fun rubber match. Because the 2017 Warriors are the best roster ever assembled, in my opinion. And the 2017 Warriors won 15 consecutive playoff games. Think about that. Like, I don't even know if we've had a team win 15 straight regular season games this year. And the Warriors literally won 15 straight playoff games in that 2017 run. So, like, they were just completely unbeatable. But I do think that 2017 Cavs is playing with a little bit of fire just with where they were at defensively at that point in the season. And it was really just effort and focus and, like, discipline type stuff. Hey, Jason, I like your explanation on why it's a better strategy to lean into higher field goal percentage shots at the end of close games. Is it also better to take higher field goal percentage shots when you have a decent lead to lower the variance of the game and lean into the trending outcome? So in general, I believe you lean on shot value in the large sample. At the end of games, yes, you want to hunt high field goal percentage. Also, it's about feeling the game. So for instance, like, when you have a guy that you need to get in rhythm that hasn't been involved in the offense, you want to find a way to get him in rhythm. When the other team, let's say you have an 18-point lead and the other team scores 3-4 baskets in a row and they're starting to regain control, that's a possession where it's really important for you to identify a high field goal percentage shot rather than a high shot value type of shot. And again, for those of you guys who don't understand what I'm saying, like, shooting 35% from three is a higher value shot than shooting 45% on a two, right? But in that singular possession, 45% is more than 35%. So that's what I mean. In a large sample, I want to lean into shot value. You want to take the highest value shot. But feeling out the game, identifying when it's important, when you need baskets, those pivotal possessions, having really smart ball handlers that will track down high value shots within that specific possession in terms of field goal percentage, usually are the teams that manage the flow of offense over a game better. Next question. Really want to get into podcasting, but I really don't know where to start. Love basketball, but I would primarily talk about football at the college and professional level. Any tips on how to start? So a couple things. It's a blessing and a curse. I think it's the best possible time in the history of the industry to get involved because anybody can do it and you don't need a ton in terms of investment upfront. Like, I personally have a podcast that I do separate from this that I produce myself still to this day, just like I used to with my basketball stuff before the Volume came on board. And for Two Sons podcast, what I'll do is, like, we recorded an episode at my buddy's house talking about Shogun the other day. And literally I set up my phone on a tripod and it automatically pairs with my MacBook as a webcam. And then I had a microphone that I used, a cheap plug-in microphone that I had. So, like, you can literally you could buy a used MacBook, you know, for what, $300-$400, and you can use whatever iPhone you have and buy a tripod for $30 on Amazon and get a microphone for $30 on Amazon and have all the equipment you need to produce a podcast. You can use, like, there are apps like Spotify for podcasters that allow you literally to host a podcast for free, right? Like, there are YouTube is an incredible tool that is completely free for you to distribute content. Social media is an incredible place for you to put content out and advertise your podcast, right? So, like, it has never been a better time for you to get involved. The flip side of that, though, is that it's a very flooded field. So if you do it very casually and you don't invest a ton of time into it, you have to be prepared for that process to be more slow. because there are going to be a lot of people out there that are relentless with producing content. That was a big thing that separated for me when I was getting into this industry. I covered every single Lakers game after the game. We went live right after every single Lakers game. And so like we were first and we were going every day basically. And then in between I'd cover the rest of the league by myself in these like other podcasts that I would do. So like I was really, really grinding at it. And I was fortunate. I had a flexible job at the time. So I was able to kind of just fit it in there. I had a wife who's very supportive and was helping me, pursue my dream of trying to make this happen. So like, just keep in mind, it is flooded. So like, if you want to separate yourself, you have to separate yourself through quality work and through consistency of your work. As far as how to do it, like it's really this simple. Set up your shit and record. Get something out there. When you do, distribute it everywhere. Have it on a podcast feed, have it on YouTube. Make sure you take clips of it, put it on social media to direct people to those feeds. As far as what content you cover, that's the beautiful thing about YouTube. You can have a podcast titled whatever, but on YouTube, you can just target whatever that specific subject matter is. So for me, my two sons podcast with my buddy Luke, we cover a lot of like TV shows and specific and movies, but specifically I'm big into fantasy, right? So like I love Star Wars, I love Lord of the Rings, I love Game of Thrones. Like Shogun is something that's right up my alley in terms of what I enjoy and appreciate, obviously with the history element of it. And so like the branding of the episode is surrounding the subject matter. It's kind of like these shows, like you guys see, like I just do a show, but we have a team of people that is really smart about identifying what is most like interesting about whatever we're talking about, and they brand it accordingly. But like, make sure you're using YouTube, make sure you're using social media. The reason why the algorithms on those apps, they do the work for you in the sense that like, as long as you're talking about something interesting and as long as you're being interesting in terms of the watch time, those algorithms will continue to push your content out to other people. And so the point is, never been a better time to do it. I highly recommend that if it's something you're interested in doing, that you do it, just because like you can do it on the side of another career. It's a hobby, for lack of a better term, right? But as long as you, in order to separate yourself, you really have to make quality and quantity of content. And that's just something to keep in mind, because it is a very flooded industry at this point. And one last little note on that front. What works for me doesn't necessarily work for everybody. This is just my own personal experience being in this industry. And I, as is always the case, I think it's important to pick the brains of lots of different people that bring different perspectives, because again, what works for me might not work for you, and what works for you might not work for me. It's just, you know, everyone's unique in that regard. How important will an improved Jaylen Brown be in a playoff series? Over the last 15 games, he has a blistering 67% field goal percentage and 8.2 half-court drives per game while only turning the ball over 3.1% of the time. How useful will his paint penetration be in a potential Milwaukee or Cleveland series? I think Jaylen Brown's improvement is super exciting, mainly just because he's found a way to impact games in a way that doesn't rely on his skill as much. Obviously, he's playing a very high level skill game right now, but he's really leveraging his athletic tools on both ends of the floor, both as an on-ball defender and then also as a physical rim pressure guy. As you've been talking, he's been one of the main drivers of the Celtics have been the third best paint offense in the league over the last seven games, so like 2 weeks or so. And Jaylen Brown's been the primary driving force behind that. So I absolutely think it's encouraging, and I absolutely think that it could help in the playoffs. The main reason why is like, so much of basketball can be mental. And so having the ability to lean on athletic gifts when you're not confident mentally is a great way to keep impacting winning. And I just feel better about Jaylen Brown's resiliency as a playoff impactor this year as a result. Next question. Do you think the NBA would ever consider doing away with the 1-8 conference separated playoffs and instead go for a 1-16 March Madness style bracket? I think it would be incredible to see a 7-game series between teams and players we wouldn't otherwise see. And I think it would open up the opportunity for all-time legends to face off where they otherwise wouldn't. They'll never do that just because of travel. It's just too unrealistic to be. Imagine a game four, five, six, seven in basically the same two cities going back and forth. Like it wouldn't work if you were going across the country. What do you think is the realistic ceiling of the Timberwolves, and what is their championship window? This team is clearly well-built right now, but it's interesting to see that there is an age gap between the Anthony Edwards, Cat McDaniels group and the Rudy Gobert, Mike Conley group. I see the issue of relying too heavily on Ant to generate for us and grind down half-court offense situations, and I don't see how that is improved without some sort of big roster move via trade, because the cold soda ain't exactly the hottest free agent destination in the nation. I've never heard that saying before, the cold soda. My wife actually went and played college basketball up in Minnesota, though. She's told me a little bit about it. I just feel like by the time Ant Ant-Man matures enough to make the right decisions and is able to be the best player on a championship team, it'll be 3 to 4 years from now and those guys will be too old. Can we actually win a chip with this group given the deepness of the league and the odd age gaps with the core guys? A couple of things. I don't like right now what's exciting is the combination of perimeter defense and Gobert. But when you have elite perimeter defense, you don't need as much in terms of rim protection. This is something we've seen with the Nuggets, right? When you have KCP and Aaron Gordon, it doesn't make Nikola Jokic's limitations matter as much. As a matter of fact, it gives him a role that he can really thrive in defensively, right? So like that's kind of the way I look at it. In the long run, first of all, Gobert's only 31. So like in the event that you move on from Gobert, and Gobert's not really a tradable contract because of his salary number. So it like really, as far as Gobert goes, like I actually do think there's a longer window here than you think. But after Gobert, the way I look at it is you slide Kat to center and then you just have to find a Aaron Gordon-esque type of power forward to put next to him. You got to find somebody that can essentially be the low man, that can be a rim protector and rebounder that allows Karl Towns to be aggressive in pick and roll coverages up at the level where he can use his intelligence more than the physical gifts that he has, right? And so from that perspective, like I actually am not really worried about the timeline stuff. And I do think Ant is advancing at a fast enough rate that I think you'll be able to capitalize on the Gobert window at some point. A few more. Do you feel like it is a lock for the 2024 Larry O'Brien Trophy to be hoisted up by a Western Conference or Eastern Conference team? I argue that the West has arguably been the more difficult conference, particularly this season with the amount of tanking / unorganized teams in the East. So I'm on the fence because I look at the Clippers and the Bucks as like I put the Clippers slightly above the Bucks, but they've been struggling as of late. And then now the Suns are playing better, so I got to kind of factor them into that list a little bit. I would say that I'd give it like an 80% chance that either Denver or Boston wins. They feel like the clear, obvious choices. And I definitely lean closer towards Denver in that regard. So then the question becomes, out of that Phoenix, Clippers, Bucks group, who's more likely? And I still lean towards the West between those two teams versus that one. So like, I'm going to go with the Western Conference on that one. I think the Bucks might be the best chance to beat the Nuggets in the finals. The gap between the two teams isn't as large as people make it seem. I'm a fan of both teams, mainly because of Giannis and Jokic are my favorite players to watch over the past 3 years. Can you provide in details the advantages that either team has if this wants to play out potentially in the finals? Because I don't believe any other team, even the Celtics, can beat Milwaukee in the East. So I disagree in the sense that I think Milwaukee has their work cut out for them to get out of the East, but I do think they have a legitimate chance to get out. So with that being the case, looking quickly at matchups, Brook Lopez is another guy who will struggle to guard Nikola Jokic over the course of a series. He's had some success with him over the years, but he's got a high enough center of gravity that Jokic can kind of bump him off. Aaron Gordon is actually a decent matchup for Giannis. I think that let's look first at the Denver on offense. Jokic working against Lopez, Giannis on the back line, that's like as good of a duo as you could find there because Giannis has that ability to kind of be in two places at once, and I think they will have some success there. Where I worry about Milwaukee is at the guard position. We just saw D'Angelo Russell cook Dame Lillard in large part because of the size differential. These bigger skill guards are starting to give Milwaukee some issues. This has been an issue that we've seen kind of as of late in general with Milwaukee. And I worry about Jamal Murray just like really, really causing problems for their backcourt just because of how much bigger he is than all of them. And then I don't think like a guy like Jay Crowder can hang with a guy like Jamal either. So I worry about that a little bit. You need to keep that size on the weak side because Michael Porter Jr. is a guy who can really do damage on the offensive glass. And then obviously you need a guy who can bother him with contests at his height. So I like how they match up with Denver in the front court. Just in the sense that I think Giannis is as good of a low man as you could have in that situation, kind of helping off of Aaron Gordon. But I worry about them in the backcourt. On the other end of the floor, Jokic and Aaron Gordon is about as good a front line as you could have to deal with the Giannis problem, right? And then they're going to throw KCP on Dame for the entire series. Again, the Aaron Gordon with Jokic behind him is going to be something they're going to be able to do against Giannis and have some success. I've seen even in EuroLeague basketball, Jokic do a decent job guarding Giannis for stretches. So like, I just think the Nuggets are a better team. I think they match up a little bit better. I think that they're going to have an easier time generating quality shots. That doesn't mean Milwaukee can't win. I think it would absolutely, utterly depend on Dame just being an absolute superstar. Because in that event, if you can actually force the Nuggets to bring Jokic way up to the level of the screen and exist in rotation and kill teams with the Dame Giannis pick and roll, I think they can have some success. But I would still lean Denver in that matchup. Two more quick ones. A lot of people upset that I didn't mention D'Angelo Russell in the last podcast. I swear I talked about him. He was the hero of the game. He made the biggest play of the game at the end with that floater. I mentioned him having 21 points in the fourth quarter. I don't really understand. There's a segment of Lakers fans that think I hate D'Lo, which is just completely nonsensical. D'Lo's won me over this year. I'm a huge fan of D'Lo. Even before the season, I had no issues with D'Lo. I just looked at it as, next to Austin Reeves, he was the obvious guy that you had to trade just based on his salary number, the years left on his contract, and the fact that he wasn't as playable in the playoffs last year. Two things have changed. One, I was super impressed. Even when D'Lo wasn't playing very well, I was impressed with his professionalism. And then since he rejoined the starting lineup a couple months ago, he's just been a better player. And like, again, this is something I harp about on the show, but like, I'm going to respond to new information. And so like, D'Lo's a better basketball player now than he was when I was saying some of the things I said about him over the summer. Like, that's just a fact. And so I'm not married to any opinion. I don't have any personal beef with D'Lo. I like D'Lo a lot. He's now become one of my favorite players because I've learned to love not just his personality and his professionalism, but now he's also improved so much that there's a lot to love just on the basketball side of things. So like, I did mention him last night. Big fan of him. Don't really know what else to say. Last question. Hey, Jason, do you really think the Bucks defense got so awesome just because the Bucks won on a small win streak against bad teams except the Clippers? It doesn't seem like they are really any better than they were before Doc Rivers got there, and the offense is definitely slower and worse off. So a couple things. First of all, I actually am more encouraged about their offense than I've been all season just because some of the stuff they're figuring out with the Dame Giannis pick and roll. They're just starting to figure out some stuff in terms of their spacing and their timing on the rolls that is really encouraging. As for the defense, I wanted to wait for this West Coast trip to really evaluate them for that very reason, and they haven't defended well. So like, I still have major defensive concerns, but I do think they're trying harder since Doc Rivers came, and there's still plenty of time here down the stretch of the season to evaluate them further, which we will do so. All right, guys, that is all I have for today. As always, I sincerely appreciate you guys for supporting the show. The plan as of right now, we're going to be going tomorrow with a quick instant reaction on a couple of games and another mailbag in the morning, and then we will have a live reaction to Kings Lakers tomorrow night on YouTube after the final buzzer. I will see you guys then.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
So, should we go electric?
I think we should go electrified with Toyota.
Electrified?
Electrified means options. Yes, we could go all electric with a Toyota bZ4X, but then there are hybrids like Grand Highlander, or we could do something in between like a RAV4 plug-in hybrid.
So, Toyota is electrified diversified?
Yep, and with more options for reducing carbon emissions, the closer we all get to Toyota's Beyond Zero vision for the future.
Exactly how much coffee have you had this morning?
Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.